Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is with us now, having a busy week, including a bipartisan agreement on a gun trafficking bill and the introduction of a new minimum wage bill she helped to write. She's getting ready for hearings next week on sexual assault in the military, and maybe she even hung around and listened to some of Rand Paul's filibuster against assassination by drone. We'll find out. Hi, Senator. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's a delight to be on your show.
Can we start with the minimum wage? Is it the $9 an hour wage the president mentioned in his State of the Union address?
It's actually higher. My goal, I'm working with Senator Harkin, is to make sure the minimum wage gets up to $10.10 over the next 3 years. Because minimum wage is really hurting New York families. It's hurting women. 64% of minimum wage earners are women. And a lot of these women are single moms, and they do not have enough money to feed their kids. And in fact, if you are earning the minimum wage, you're earning about $3,000 below the poverty line if you have kids. It's disgraceful that we think it's acceptable that people who work full-time can't even earn enough to get above the poverty line.
We played clips earlier in the show from a Republican mayoral hopeful's debate here in New York City yesterday, and a couple of the candidates mentioned a two-tier minimum wage, maybe by age, age 24 or something like that, so that you can still give a lot of jobs to teenagers and, you know, people just starting out, but for people who are trying to support a family on that it be higher. You think anything like that might work?
Look, most people on minimum wage are not teenagers. They are not young people. They're actually adults, particularly women with children are those who are earning minimum wage. So I think that is a red herring. I think that is not acceptable. And frankly, no one should be earning below the poverty line if they are working 40 hours a week. You're not talking about a kid with a summer job. You're talking about people working full-time to feed their families. So I have grave concerns about trying to water down the minimum wage. I think everyone should be earning $10 an hour.
Next issue. I see you'll be holding hearings next week on sexual assault in the military. Is this a result of the Oscar-nominated documentary Invisible War?
I think the film has done a great service to the American people because it brought to light what is actually happening to these men and women who are sexually assaulted and raped in the military and how devastating it is to their lives. Not just the horror of the crime, but then not being taken seriously within the military and getting justice. And justice denied means that these women and men continue to suffer. So we are going to continue to shine that light on this issue. Our hearing is going to be the first hearing on the issue in about a dozen years. It's going to start with the testimony of victims and what happened to them and whether their cases were taken seriously, whether they received justice, what types of red tape they had to go through. And then we're going to hear from the military commanders, people who are actually dealing with this issue and trying to implement policies to change what's happening in the military. I think it is a huge issue because it undermines not just military readiness, but also undermines troop morale. It undermines unit cohesion. And it basically means some of our best and brightest are taken out of service and can't serve. So we need to do better by these men and women. And we need to make sure we get this done. But this is an issue that we've been working on since I've been in the Senate, actually. Mm-hmm. And we've been trying to change a lot of things about how women are treated. Number one, we wanted to make sure they had access to reproductive services as they were raped. We were able to change some of that law over the last year. We also have been working on getting women the credit for the combat they've already been engaged in. Letting women serve in combat roles is important because it's necessary for their promotion. It's necessary for certain leadership roles. And since women have been dying on the front lines and engaging in combat in both Iraq and Afghanistan, that's something we've pushed for and the military has finally agreed to.
We had the director of the film Invisible War twice on the show and we played clips. And maybe the most shocking footage for me, in addition to the victims telling their stories, was the interview with the woman in charge of stopping sexual assault in the military, whose name I forget, who appeared completely clueless about enforcement or prosecution and focused only on telling women to be careful out there. Is it that pathetically bad?
Well, I think, you know, that was one of the more infuriating part of the films, because this is not about a date gone bad. This is not, you know, ask her when she's sober. I've never heard more offensive treatment of this issue. These are violent crimes by perpetrators who are often stalking their victims in advance, finding the right time to commit these crimes. These are crimes of violence, and they have to be treated as such. So you have to not only create a climate where someone could report the rape or the sexual assault, meaning not directly to their commanding officer, and that's been changed. That's something Secretary Panetta has already changed after seeing the film. But they have to be able to get justice within the system. And so I think this hearing is going to be able to begin to look at what does it take to get the conviction rate higher? You know, what are the prosecutions not doing? But also, what does it take to get the reporting higher? Mm-hmm. If the estimate is that there's 19,000 sexual assaults and rapes within the military a year, but only, you know, approximately 2,500 are reported and are even reviewed, and then only about 250 actually go to trial, you're talking about such a minuscule percentage of women and men getting their cases heard and having the opportunity to get justice. The other statistic that disturbs me greatly, Brian, is that a third of perpetrators who have been convicted are still serving in the military. It is a huge problem.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat from New York, my guest here on WNYC. Speaking of the military, were you on the floor for any of Rand Paul's filibuster?
Unfortunately, no. I did not get to hear my colleague speak for the last dozen or so hours.
You know, Ron Wyden was the only Democrat to join in. This isn't a civil liberties issue or a, you know, human rights issue that a New York Democrat would support.
The issue with regard to drones.
And I get maybe we should clarify for the audience. Technically, he was filibustering the nomination of John Brennan to be CIA director, but his specific issue seemed to be no drone attacks against Americans on U.S. soil without due process if they're not about to attack something. So, you know, maybe we can strike a suspected al-Qaeda leader in a cafe in Pakistan, but not a U.S. citizen in a cafe in the United States, as opposed to if they're trying to fly a plane into the Pentagon. And for some reason, as I understand it, Attorney General Holder has had a hard time getting to a clear answer on that.
These are legitimate issues that have to be raised and debated. I think the use of drones is a very serious issue. Obviously, there are very serious civil liberties issues, especially when focused on what the use of drones could be with regard to American citizens. I also have concerns when innocent people are killed, especially children. Those are very grave, grave tragedies, and it means that something terribly wrong has happened. So we need to have the proper safeguards, and we have to have accountability to prevent that. So I think the issue of discussing and debating drones is very important, and one of my jobs in the Armed Services Committee is going to make sure that we have proper oversight, that we can have hearings about this, that we can look at evidence, that we can have a strong debate about how do we make judgments about the appropriate usage of drones. But I can say one thing. As the senator from New York, we've had over a dozen terror attempts since 9/11. Drones have been used very effectively in fighting terrorism and keeping our troops in the field safe and making sure that they don't have to necessarily be on the ground to continue to fight terrorism.
So you wouldn't want a blanket no drones against U.S. citizens on U.S. soil blanket policy or interpretation of the Constitution?
I support that view. That is something that concerns me gravely. I don't see the appropriate usage of drones on U.S. soil against U.S. citizens. I have very serious civil liberty concerns on that issue.
And coming up in a few minutes, listeners, we'll play a montage of moments from Senator Paul's 13-hour filibuster coming up. Senator Gillibrand with us now. And next issue, everyone's favorite, the sequester budget. Do you think New York State is feeling the impact yet?
I think there are very serious concerns for New Yorkers about how these cuts will be made. My concern with it, and one of the reasons why I did not vote for this, because I knew these cuts would be so devastating to New York. You know, the people who are being hurt are the kids who are going to be taken off early childhood education rosters, the kids who have special needs who will no longer have a teacher to be able to teach them. There's cuts to mental health that, you know, obviously with the concerns we have about mental health and what happened at Sandy Hook, that is something that I think is just the wrong kind of approach for saving money. Our seniors, senior meals are going to be cut. When you talk about emergency issues, FEMA is going to be cut. Issues regarding TSA and traffic safety. Food safety will be cut, meaning we aren't going to have inspectors to make sure foodborne illnesses don't come into our country through our foods. But, you know, as a New Yorker, I am very concerned that we are cutting both Sandy aid and we are cutting the funds that we worked so hard to get for the 9/11 first responders for their health care. These men and women have sacrificed so much already. We should not be balancing the budget on their backs. These cuts should never have been in play. And for our Sandy victims, they're just trying to rebuild their lives, rebuild their homes, rebuild their businesses. And for that funding to be cut, I think is a grave error. So I'm concerned. These are the wrong cuts for trying to balance the budget. They never should have been put in place, and I'm just going to fight tooth and nail to try to have us go back to the drawing board, figure out how to have this balanced budget in a more balanced way without the kind of harm that's being caused to a lot of high priorities, mm-hmm. Certainly for our state and for a lot of our families.
Toward that balanced approach, on Meet the Press Sunday, Speaker of the House John Boehner seemed to crack the window open just a wee bit for a comprehensive deal. And it seemed to involve the Senate Democrats passing a budget that includes some of the entitlement cuts President Obama said he would make as part of a bigger bargain, and closing tax loopholes and lowering some other tax rates. He said if the Senate actually does it and you all vote on it, that maybe there's something to negotiate on. Is there any chance that Senate Democrats might come up with something comprehensive like that and pass it off to Boehner in the House?
Yes, that is exactly what Senator Patty Murray is working on. She is working on a budget to present to our caucus to take us through that she intends to be very balanced. I think she will look at how do we strengthen our entitlements but also save money. She will also look at what kinds of savings can we have that are more reasonable and appropriate. And then she will also look at how to change tax rates so that we can raise the revenue that are necessary. I think we will have a strong budget that Patty will deliver to us in the next couple of weeks, and I am very eager to see what she talks about. I think the president's been working on this balance for a long time. I think he's offered many approaches to the Republican leadership, so I'm hopeful that we can find common ground. Look, Brian, the only way anything gets done in Washington is if you start from an area of common ground, and you've got to find that and start from there and build from there. And, you know, one of the areas we're having success on right now is on guns, an issue that for years has been untouchable. We are really moving forward with bipartisan support on one of the bills that I worked on and some of the other bills. So I know it can be done. We just have to, you know, find that common ground and build from there.
And that was the next issue I wanted to ask you about, is this bipartisan agreement on a bill to fight gun trafficking. And I see that this has now gotten through the Judiciary Committee. Congratulations. Is this the same as or different from the president's proposals that we keep hearing about regarding assault weapons, large magazines, and universal background checks?
This is one of the proposals. This is a bill that I started working on in 2009 when I was first appointed. Because New York suffers from a lot of gun crime. We have gang violence. We have criminal networks. And one of our biggest challenges is that 85% of the weapons used in crimes come from out of state, and 90% of those weapons are illegal. So what you're talking about is roughly 9 out of 10 guns used in crimes. They're trafficked illegally straight into the hands of criminals. And you will not believe this, but there is no federal law that says you cannot traffic or be a straw purchaser. None at all. And so when law enforcement is trying to go after these guys, they have to cobble together local laws and figure out how to go after them. But they have no authority to work with the feds to go across state lines to find the traffickers and crack down on this. So this bill has been shaped on a bipartisan basis over the last few months. I'm very excited about it passing out of committee. I was also grateful that Senator Grassley voted yes on that. So we have broad bipartisan support. We have Grassley's support, along with Senator Collins' support, along with Mark Kirk's support. Now, Mark and I worked together to drop this bill about a month and a half ago, to be the first bipartisan bill. But the bipartisan support will continue to grow, and I think this is an issue we can all agree on. Criminals shouldn't have weapons. Law enforcement should have the tools to go after them.
And it's interesting that you think you can do something about this at the federal level. We had the NYPD commissioner on the show recently and the deputy commissioner, too, and they were saying that Pennsylvania and Virginia are the number one and two states for exporting illegal weapons to New York, and precisely because of those things, lax laws against straw purchasers and things like that, that let guns that are intended to be sold on the black market get into the system. You think the federal government can stop that?
I do, because when I wrote this bill in 2009, the first version of it, I worked with ATF and the FBI and the NYPD and Commissioner Kelly on what tools do you need to convict these criminals. And that's how the bill started. So this bill really has been written by law enforcement in the first instance. It's been shaped and added to. Senator Leahy and Senator Durbin have added to it as well. And it's a very strong bill, and I think it's a good first step. We should absolutely do the background checks as well, along with banning the military-style weapons and the large ammunition clips. But I believe with all issues that require social change, you need to build on each success, because every success allows a platform for the next success, and we begin to change popular opinion on about what we can do and how we can make our community safer. I can't tell you how upsetting it is for me as a mom to have watched these gun crimes over the last few years, and how heartbreaking it is for any parent in our state to see how devastating it is to lose a loved one, especially a child. And I believe it is a mandate for us all to do better and work much harder on finding that common ground and beginning to solve the problem.
All right. Last thing, little pop culture. I read that you told BuzzFeed that you read The Hunger Games as a women's rights book, but were disappointed in the ending. Why was that?
Well, have you read the book?
I haven't.
The book? Okay, well, then you won't understand it fully. And for anyone listening who wants to read the books, this is a spoiler alert, so don't listen to my answer.
Spoiler alert from Senator Gillibrand.
So the book is about this young woman who is living in a society where people are starving to death. And she is called into this combative game where you have to survive. But if you do survive, your town receives a lot of extra food, and you begin to address the grave hunger that they're facing. So it's a horrible book of this terrible post-apocalyptic time. But this woman shows extraordinary strength. So she survives this first episode in the first book. In the second book, she begins to become more self-empowered and wants to start a revolution. In the third book, she wins the revolution, kills the bad person in the book. But afterwards, she just retires. She doesn't take that experience to create a call to action, to engage others, to fight for justice, or use any of that life experience to help others or move the ball forward. And so that was what was so disappointing. She just retires to a quiet life, and I just wanted her to be a leader and take on a greater role of justice for the people in her community. That's all. And so I was just disappointed because she does nothing at the end. She just goes home. And her old boyfriend is the one who becomes the leader and becomes the advocate for equality and justice. And so I was very disappointed that she did not pick up the mantle of justice for others at the end. And this is after she's accomplished amazing things.
Yes.
So I wanted her to go the next step at the end.
You got any other good culture picks right now?
No. I'm reading Cairo's book right now, which is fantastic about LBJ.
Uh-huh.
So for people who like history, it's a great, great book.
New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, we always appreciate you coming on. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll come back and play that montage of moments from Rand Paul's 13-hour filibuster. Stay with us.